This is Josh Barrow, and welcome to Left, Right, and Center, your civilized yet provocative antidote to the self-contained opinion bubbles that dominate political debate. It was the last week of April, and this week Joe Biden gave his first address as president to a joint session of Congress. Technically, it's not a State of the Union address in the first year, but it functions like a State of the Union address, and Biden touted his record from his first 100 days in office. He also talked about the agenda he wants Congress to pass, including the George Floyd Justice and Policing Act, trillions of dollars in new spending on infrastructure and social programs, and new taxes on corporations and the highest-earning Americans. The ratings for this speech, I will note, were low. 27 million Americans tuned in, down from 48 million who watched Trump's first joint session address, 52 million for Obama, a whopping 67 million for Bill Clinton in 1993. But then, wasn't that sort of the point? One of the key propositions of the Biden campaign was he'd be a president you didn't have to pay so much attention to, and many Americans on both sides of the aisle seem to have taken him up on that. To talk about the speech, let's bring in our left, right, and center panel. As always, I'm your center. This week, I'm joined by a new panelist on the right, Rachel Bovard, Senior Director of Policy at the Conservative Partnership Institute. Hello, Rachel.
Hi there. Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. And on the left, Gustavo Arellano, columnist at the Los Angeles Times and host of the new daily podcast, The Times. Hey, Gustavo.
Hola, Josh.
And our special guest this week again is Kelly Goff. Kelly is a left, right, and center contributor, a screenwriter and producer, and a contributor at The Daily Beast, The Guardian, and The Hollywood Reporter. Hello, Kelly.
Hey, Josh.
So, Gustavo, can you make a case that this speech was exciting?
It was so boring. I was one of the, 310 million Americans who didn't tune in. It was so boring that when I actually played it, I played it, found it on YouTube or somewhere, I clocked out after 5 minutes. It was so boring that when I actually read it, and this is absolutely true because I read it late at night, I fell asleep and I had to wake myself up. All of that said, I think it really just illustrates to the point that you said that, you know, Biden is telling the world, look, I'm not going to be a JFK. I'm not going to be an Obama. I'm definitely not going to be a Trump. I'm just a kid from Scranton, Pennsylvania, and Scranton is, not exactly the most exciting town out there, but I'm going to give you things that we need right now. So in that sense, at least what he's promising is incredibly extraordinary. And I'll save my thought for something else. I'll just leave it there for right now.
I completely disagree, Josh, and I do want to make this. No, I'm joking. I'm completely joking.
Oh, I was so hopeful. I thought someone was going to make this case. I mean, it's funny to me for a couple of reasons. One is that, even when more people watch these speeches, they were always kind of boring. People have this idea that these speeches used to be scintillating. And actually, the funny thing with this is these speeches have always been dry as hell. And they're like that for a reason, which is that they are an opportunity for the president to lay out his policy agenda, what he has done, what he's planning to do. And the details of these things are usually not, the matter of big soaring rhetoric. They're specific, here's what I did and here's what I'm going to be asking you to do. And the substance of this in Biden's speech, $2 trillion of spending that has already been passed by Congress within his first 100 days, yet another enormous fiscal relief package, some of which is intended to be permanent, this child allowance that would be a significant ongoing new benefit to families, especially lower income families going forward, and then trillions more in spending for infrastructure and for social programs, and very large tax increases that are intended to finance at least part of that. So the thing is that this speech, even though it landed with a relatively small footprint in the news cycle, it covers a very significant policy agenda that I think liberals should have a lot of reason to be excited about, and conservatives should have a lot of reason to be wary about. But Rachel, I've just found it remarkable that it's not just that Democrats are not as fired up as they might otherwise be. I feel like Republicans, they have areas of complaint about the president. They don't seem as exercised as I would expect them to be about the very aggressive, frankly, big government fiscal agenda that he is advancing.
Well, first, I think I disagree a little bit with the premise that these speeches are supposed to be dry and boring, because I think in many cases, they present opportunities to really rally the country and bring us together. Because remember, Joe Biden ran as a unifier. That was his primary message. And we haven't heard a lot from Joe Biden, and maybe that's by design. So this was going to be one of the first platforms, I think, for him to prove that he had that unifying appeal, that unifying agenda. And I really think it fell flat. You know, another part of why I think I agree was boring was because it was also missing that human element. You know, so much of previous State of the Unions, or in this case, a joint address, have been, you know, talking about a policy and then pointing to a guest who sort of represents the problem that you're trying to solve. And, you know, in this case, we didn't see that because, again, we saw completely vaccinated people, you know, all sitting distantly from each other in the sort of dystopian joint address on the floor of the House. But I think, you know, Republicans really, for the ones who tuned in, I think we're looking to see if Biden could offer a unifying agenda in two areas. They were looking to see him propose ways in which we could work together, right, as the moderate Joe Biden. And they were also looking for appeals across the aisle. And I think Biden whiffed on both of those things. He laid out a list of things that, you know, Democrats exclusively want to focus on and have no interest in working with conservatives or Republicans, I would argue. And second, you know, he missed, I think, clear opportunities to hand an olive branch to all of the voters that voted for Trump. You know, he talked about, you know, the people that worked on the vaccine without mentioning the Trump administration's work on Operation Warp Speed. And, you know, the fact that Trump was ridiculed when he said everybody could have access to the vaccine in April. And then that proved to be the case. So I think he missed key opportunities to be the candidate he said he was going to be as president, which was a unifier. Stephen Collinson at CNN called his speech moderately radical, which I'm not really sure what that means, but, you know, seems to kind of sum it up.
Kelly, what do you make of that? I mean, sometimes I feel like the when you hear that the president hasn't put out enough olive branches, that sometimes that seems to amount to, you know, why isn't your policy agenda a lot different and a lot closer to ours than it is? But Rachel lays out one thing there, which is basically, why not find more opportunities to talk about the continuity in vaccine policy between the Trump administration and the Biden administration, give a little more credit going backwards. I don't know the extent to which that would change perceptions of the speech, but that's one of the first things that I've heard that's an idea about what it would mean to be unifying, that's not really about, you know, just please adopt more of our policy agenda.
Well, I think in the same way that Rachel challenges the premise of the question, I would challenge the premise of her response a little bit. I think there are certainly some Republicans who were looking for signs of ways in which they could work together with Joe Biden, but a lot of Republicans were looking for opportunities to find leverage to run against him or his agenda, either in the next presidential election, which I know a lot of people don't believe Biden will be running, but whatever Democrats running, but also in some of these upcoming Senate races, right, like Warnock, et cetera, trying to find ways in which there is leverage from a speech like this that could be used to sort of, as she was just quoting the CNN person, paint the entire party as radical, right? Because you have people like AOC who actually said that they've been essentially pleasantly surprised by his first 100 days, which I think none of us on this panel today would have predicted, you know, 100 days ago, she'd be saying. So there's that. But what I would also say is, you know, one of the things I think we can't forget when we kind of hype up these speeches, Josh, and we talk as a political nerd, I'm sure I could try to defend how these speeches are kind of always exciting to those of us who it appeals to either our wonkiness or our interest in political history. But one of the things I think shouldn't get lost here, right, is that Ronald Reagan was considered the great communicator. Barack Obama was considered a JFK-esque in some of his speeches when he needed to really deep down, such as the speech on race that he gave during his first campaign following the Reverend Wright controversy. Joe Biden is someone who overcame a stutter, right? And he is someone who is very proud to talk about the fact that his ability to give speeches at all is frankly not just a great accomplishment, but it's something that actually speaks to every kid out there who is struggling with a stutter and doesn't think they'd ever be able to do what he did this week. So I just want to make sure that we kind of temper expectations. He was never really the JFK of speakers. That's not his thing. Was I looking for that? Not really. You know, was anyone looking for that? I don't think they were tuning into his speech for excitement.
Isn't this a radical agenda, though? And I don't mean that as a word with value judgment. An agenda could be radical in a way that you like, in a way that you don't like. But I mean, when you add up these new programs that he's proposing, the trillions of dollars in new spending, this is an expansion of government on a scale that we have not seen since the Great Society in the 1960s. And it's sort of in such a wide variety of policy areas. We had this very large infrastructure proposal that, you know, there's some stuff in there that I wouldn't call infrastructure, but it really, even if you look at just the hard infrastructure components, you're looking at well over $1 trillion in new infrastructure. infrastructure spending, and then what Biden's calling the American Families Act, paid parental leave, childcare subsidies, pre-K all across the country, expansion of that child allowance that's already been imposed for 1 year in one of the prior laws, free community college, bigger Pell Grants. It's basically, it's a wish list for Democrats. And again, I don't mean that in a way that expresses a value judgment. The things that are maybe on your wish list for a good reason. But it seems to me that, you know, while the speech was not rhetorically very exciting, it feels like, you know, Republicans would like to call this radical. I think they have a fairly good case for calling it radical. And I just find it weird how subsumed that discussion seems to be in our politics.
Yeah. Can I just say, though, it's not that I think you're wrong. I think that you would have been more correct before the pandemic. One example would be, paid leave and subsidies for working mothers, because so many women, as you mentioned in a speech, are leaving the workforce and may never come back, Josh, right? Because they simply couldn't juggle having to care for an elderly family member or a child while also trying to work full time from home and doing the homeschooling and the whole thing. That affects a lot of conservative women who maybe a year ago would have said, not the government's responsibility. I believe in personal responsibility. I don't need Uncle Sam trying to help me manage my household. And then the pandemic shifted realities for a lot of Americans who never thought they'd be in a food line. And so that's part of what I think is at play here, Josh, is I think a year ago, some of this stuff would have been considered super controversial, super extremely liberal and progressive. And now there are people who do not define themselves as liberals or progressives who don't think some of his policies sound as wacky as they would have before COVID.
No, it's completely radical. I love it. I absolutely love it, because this is buyer's remorse for the Republican Party. Do we really think Hillary Clinton would have pushed any of this if she had won in 2016? No, she would have hewed the road, very centrist, very boring. The Republicans could have gotten a candidate that was not going to be as whacked out as Trump. And when this pandemic finally happened, maybe they would have had somebody who held the line. But they were so afraid of Hillary that they put all their money with Trump. We know what happened with Trump. And here's Sleepy Joe coming out with being a combination of LBJ, JFK, and FDR. So the speech is a total Trojan horse, everything that he's proposing. And yeah, there's more people now that are predisposed to embrace what he's doing, but it's great. And the reason why you're not seeing so much feedback from the Republican Party is because they're woozy. They're completely woozy. They're like, we can't believe Joe's actually getting away with this. What can we do? They're just like, they're kind of like a dog, running around with its, trying to catch its tail. And meanwhile, Joe Biden takes off with the kibbles and bits or something.
Rachel, what do you say to that? Is the era of small government over?
No. Look, I think that Kelly is right. I think that COVID did really, I think, change a lot of perspectives about, you know, what government can and should do in a crisis. But I think Biden's wrong if he thinks he can keep taking advantage of that crisis to push through what is, you know, a pretty radical agenda. And I think that was one of the notable things about this speech, as staid as the delivery was. It had this drumbeat of crisis. Everything is a crisis. The climate is a crisis. Terrorism is a crisis. Nuclear proliferation, cybersecurity, you know, down the line, everything he listed is a crisis. And it's clear that he intends to use that framing to push through the most dramatic expansion of government, you know, that we've seen in generations. Now, I also, though, disagree with Kelly's characterization a little bit that there weren't areas in which Republicans would work with Joe Biden. Is this about politics? Of course it is, right? The Biden agenda is purely designed to, you know, jam through as much as possible ahead of 2022 in the control of Congress. But I will say this, Republicans have made it clear, and I think the Tim Scott, you know, response made this clear, that they actually do want to work on some kind of infrastructure plan, that they actually do want to address the opioid crisis, you know, that, you know, they will engage on police reform. These are all things Republicans have brought good faith proposals to the table on. And, you know, Joe Biden sort of gives them himself the sheen of bipartisanship by patting them on the head with meetings and then flat out ignores them. And Democrats in the Senate do the same. So, you know, I think that the Republican Party is retrenching a little bit on its emphases. I do agree with that. I don't think you see deficit spending driving as much concern as it once did. But for instance, on the issue of, you know, expanded childcare, what Biden is proposing with his nationalization of preschool goes toward one end. There's a lot of conservative women who actually do want to help raising their kids, but they want to stay home and do it. That subsidy only applies to people who put their kids in daycare. There's a lot of women that don't want to do that. So again, there are areas in which we can come to the middle on some of this stuff, but Biden clearly has no interest. And I think you're going to see Republican opposition because of that.
Let's take a break. When we come back, I want to talk about the Republican response speech delivered by South Carolina Senator Tim Scott, which focused in part on one of those areas where there have been efforts to find some sort of bipartisan agreement on policing reform. I have been talking with Rachel Bovard of the Conservative Partnership Institute, Gustavo Arellano of the Los Angeles Times, and Kelly Goff, columnist and LRC contributor. This is Left, Right, and Center.
You're hearing from our left, right, and center, and we want to hear from you, too. Tweet us at LRCKCRW and download the free KCRW app to listen to Left, Right, and Center on demand.
Support for Left, Right, and Center comes from Odoo. If you feel like you're wasting time and money with your current business software or just want to know what you could be missing, then you need to join the millions of other users who switch to Odoo. Odoo is the affordable, all-in-one management software with a library of fully integrated business applications that help you get more done in less time for a fraction of the price. To learn more, visit odoo.com/LRC. That's odoo.com/LRC. Odoo, modern management made simple.
Back again with Left, Right, and Center, I'm Josh Barrow. On the right is Rachel Bovard, Senior Director of Policy at the Conservative Partnership Institute. On the left is Gustavo Arellano, columnist at the Los Angeles Times and host of The Times. And our special guest is Kelly Goff, Left, Right, and Center contributor, writer, and columnist. So Tim Scott, who is the only Black Republican in the United States Senate, delivered the response speech to Joe Biden's speech. One thing that I thought was interesting about that speech is that he really did take head on some of these big tax and spending issues that I think Republicans have been de-emphasizing in a way that I find surprising, talking about the radical nature of that agenda that I think liberals should probably be more excited about, conservatives should probably be more alarmed about. But another thing that he focused on was police reform, where Tim Scott has been the leading Republican legislator trying to develop a national agreement on some sort of policing reform. Those efforts did not succeed in 2020. He's been in negotiations, including Karen Bass, who is a Black Democrat representing Los Angeles in the House of Representatives. And this is an issue where it's been a rhetorical priority for members on both sides of the aisle, but it's not been possible to reach that sort of bipartisan agreement. So, Rachel, what do you make of the fact that, you know, the Joe Biden said in this speech, I want the George Floyd Act on my desk in a month in time for the anniversary of his death. So far, Republicans and Democrats have not been close enough together to get some piece of legislation with the votes from both parties it would need. Do you see that as something that's plausible in the next month?
I think that there is actually room for common ground here. And I think that was one of the points Tim Scott made in his response, that was the theme of it, was an appeal to reconciliation and common ground on a lot of these really key issues. And Tim Scott, as you point out, has been the vector for a lot of these discussions on the right. He had a police reform bill that he, you know, worked very hard on that fell to a Democrat filibuster, you know, late last year. Senator Rand Paul, in the wake of the death of Breonna Taylor, introduced a bill to ban no-knock warrants. That's an issue he's been passionate about for years, and it got no attention from Senate Democrats. So this is really, I think, a threshold question for Senate Democrats. And I think the way Senator Scott characterized it is correct. Do they want the issue, or do they want to actually try to work in good faith with Republicans? Because you could actually address the issue. It's just a matter of coming to the table. And so far, they haven't wanted to do that.
Gustavo, the question here seems to be, how much should Democrats compromise in pursuit of this law? Because there are some elements that Rachel mentions there where there is real bipartisan support where you could have legislation, but there are Democratic priorities for federal policing reform that have to do with racial profiling, that have to do with the ease with which you can bring federal civil rights prosecutions against police officers who act not just willfully, but recklessly in depriving people of civil rights. And those are areas where you're not going to have Republican agreement on a law. So I guess the question is, how is half a loaf good enough for Democrats? What should they be willing to do? What should they give up in order to not have the issue, in order to have a law that addresses at least some of these concerns?
Well, what we have is a philosophical disagreement between the Republicans and the Democrats over what is the root of police brutality, of police misconduct. For a lot of people on the left, they say this is something about, you know, rooted in racism. It's something that is just it's inherent in the police state. For Republicans, they say it's a few bad apples. The system itself is fine. We could reform this. You know, we could tinker with the system, but really we have to root out the bad people, but we shouldn't eradicate the whole thing. So yeah, they're kind of fundamentally at opposition with each other. But I think with the Democrats, as we talked about last week, like most Americans, they have no problem with policing. They have problems. And, you know, they'll have problems with stuff as egregious as what happened with George Floyd, Breonna Taylor, but I mean Sandra Bland. You also have to think, though, that why is it that these things keep happening again and again and again? And going to what Rachel said, I think with police reform, in a way that I never imagined, there is a possibility for reconciliation by both Republicans and Democrats for something that a lot of people seem to want, which is let's fix this problem. But they have to have a conversation with each other, and half a loaf or the full loaf. Let's go for 3/4 of a loaf. I think the Democrats should give the Republicans something. They should pay attention to what the Republicans are saying. The fact that the Republicans are even having this conversation or want to do something about it is extraordinary. Before, it was only the libertarian right who said, hey, there's something wrong with the police state. So let's, you know, hand in hand, let's do something in honor of George Floyd. And I think that's what Biden wants. That's why he's asking both sides, like, hey, let's do something before the 1-year anniversary.
Kelly, what did you make of this response speech?
I really liked it. I thought it hit all the right notes. I think, you know, one of the things people have conveniently forgotten is Donald Trump actually got, you know, more Black male voter support than Mitt Romney or John McCain. So there actually is growth opportunity for the GOP there, which especially I think now that Trump is put off to pasture. And I think he hit all the right notes. I mean, when he talked about, he showed empathy for single mothers, which is not something that the GOP is necessarily known for, when he talked about his own story, when he talked about his grandfather being illiterate, but pretending to read the newspaper every morning to set a good example, when he talked about going from cotton to Congress in one generation. I mean, that's my family story, Josh. I think I've shared this on air. My grandmother and my mother both picked cotton, and I'm sitting on this panel with you here today. That is the American dream. I thought what happened with the stuff on race was interesting and complicated. First of all, I found it interesting that so much of the analysis of his speech after the fact ended up focusing on, you know, his terminology that America is not a racist country, which he said right after listing numerous instances of racism he had personally experienced. But part of why I thought that was so interesting, Josh, is because I felt like Democrats walked right into the GOP's trap. Meaning, one of the things he talked about is the intolerance he's faced from the left and the name calling because of his politics. And then sure enough, on Twitter, a negative slur, inappropriate nickname for him was trending, and Twitter had to step in and shut it down because of his speech, which completely proved his point on that.
People were calling him Uncle Tim. I think we should probably specify for...
Yeah, exactly. And then the second part is that there was literally a study just released by Yale University that found that when Democrats focus their messaging about their policies heavily on race, it costs them with voters. So nothing was actually better, I'd say, for Republicans than having people get into this back and forth about whether or not he was inaccurate to say that America itself is not a racist country, when as an African-American, I care much less about the semantic debates and much more about the policies themselves. And that's the conversations I want to be having, is about what policies are we talking about? How do we advance, you know, expanding body cameras and the George Floyd Act and a national police misconduct registry? And I also want to say we've seen this movie before, right, where Democrats get caught flat-footed on the messaging part, right? You know, whether it's partial birth abortions, which is not a real term, but late-term abortions. And I think they really walked right into the GOP's trap. It allowed him to kind of to claim the higher ground on this issue and to say essentially what Rachel just said, right? Which is, do you want to debate the semantics or do you actually want to pass legislation that works? And so, look, I think I think the fact that Mike Pence in his first speech post leaving office gave Tim Scott a shout out really firmly establishes that Tim Scott is the future of the party and is a rising star. I think it was a really good speech. The last thing I want to say really quickly, though, Josh, too, is I think something got lost. Which is at the end of his speech, he referenced the original sin and said that's never the end of the story. It's about redemption. Tim Scott was referencing slavery. That's our country's original sin. So while I don't agree with some of his analysis about how much further we have to go on race, I thought that where he was coming from was a way that resonated as authentic. And I think that I think he did what the GOP needed him to do that evening.
A lot of commentators really hated this speech. A lot of liberal commentators, Black liberal commentators.
Of course.
And to take the strong form, the the better form of their objection rather than just sort of name calling. I think there were two things that really bothered some people on the left about this speech. One is sort of a general sense that prominent black conservatives create a permission structure for white conservatives to basically dismiss problems about race in the country. And I think that, you know, I think Scott was the, you know, as you note, he talked very explicitly about experiences of racism that he has faced and continues to face in America. And so I don't think that his statement that we're not a racist country was intended to mean that there are no problems with racism in the United States. But I think that people hear that way. And then the other thing had to do specifically with the voting law in Georgia. And I think some of the complaints about this law from the left have been overblown. Some of them have been frankly inaccurate in the details about what the law does. But I think it is true that the law in Georgia and some of these laws around the country are born out of false conspiracy theories about elections being rigged and that are essentially rooted in an idea that it's suspicious when you have political coalitions that are where black Americans are the core of that political coalition, when they win elections in the South, that's suspicious and something needs to be done about that. And obviously America has an ugly history with that. So when liberals look at this speech and they focus on those two things and they get very upset about it, I guess, do they have a point?
Well, first of all, the reason I was laughing is not because what you're saying is untrue. It just doesn't strictly apply to conservatives. I mean, hello. I mean, here in Hollywood, right? People love to point to the one African-American doing really well at their studio to prove that they don't have a problem with race. And then when you look behind the numbers, you're like, well, why is that person the only one or one of two when you have, you know, 500 people here, right? And it's a little bit, it's interesting. I was just having this conversation with someone who's working on a policy paper that's specifically looking at this issue of diversity and leadership. And the bottom line, Josh, is that the numbers are extremely low, right? Like, I think it's something like 4% in most major industries, and Black Americans have not climbed past that. But what I'll call the Tim Scott effect is exactly what you're referring to, which is that people love to point to Oprah. They love to point to Tim Scott. They love to point at Barack Obama to say, well, that seems to indicate there's not a real problem. And so I can't have that much work to do in terms of policy or systemic issues. I think it just shows that someone can do it if they really want to. And as we know, there's all sorts of data. There was just the Harvard study about minority candidates who whiten their resumes, either in terms of adjusting their name or leaving out which cultural clubs they were members of, they are significantly more likely to get job interviews. We know the data in terms of who the police pull over, particularly in specific states. So there are some systemic issues that need to be addressed. And all I'm saying to you, Josh, is it's not just Republicans who go, but we have Tim Scott, right? A lot of Americans who are in power in certain institutions and industries don't actually want to have to look internally and do the heavy lifting on either policy or structural change, because it's hard, it's inconvenient, it's expensive. But if you actually care about racial justice and equality and actually walking the walk, not just talking the talk, you have to be willing to do the heavy lifting on policies. So that's what I'm hoping to see, not just from Republicans, but across industries and across parties.
I want to get both Rachel and Gustavo in on this. And I think, you know, the speech from Tim Scott, and this isn't the first Republican response speech delivered by a black official. J.C. Watts did one all the way back in the 1990s. But a remarkable thing about Trump era politics, despite the racial controversies that were so prominent in all of it, is that it's a period in which racial polarization in American voting has been declining. And Trump made some inroads, especially with black and Hispanic men. Now, of course, Republicans still lose overwhelmingly among black voters, including black men, and also by a very wide margin among Hispanic voters. But there is this sort of, there is this demonstration that at the margin, Republicans in this era have demonstrated at least a little bit of ability to appeal somewhat better in these communities. And so, Rachel, I'm wondering what you make of that trend and the role of officials like Tim Scott in and his messaging in that trend?
Well, I think Tim Scott, his address was well done, and he's talented, and he has been talented in this way for a long time. I think he's flown under the radar in a lot of ways, intentionally, I think, on his part. But I think this was his moment to shine, and he really did it. One of the things I really appreciated about how he handled that address was that he really spoke to the struggles of the last year. And those are, you know, I think across party lines, across racial lines. And that was something that was missing from Joe Biden's speech. He talked about the fact that kids have lost a year of learning. You know, he made a point to celebrate single moms and the struggles they've been dealing with during this pandemic. You know, talked about the fact that we small businesses have been, you know, virtually eliminated in some cases, you know, by the pandemic. And I think he really tried to give it a human element, which I think was really well done. On the race issue, I think the way you characterized it was correct. I think when he is saying America is not a racist country, well, then illuminating some of the areas in which he's faced discrimination, what he's saying is that the sort of fundamental nature and essence of the country is not defined necessarily by his individual experiences. He's rejecting, I think, the argument of some on the left that America has been fundamentally racist since its founding. Every structure and institution is infused with this. We must burn it all down and build it again. That's not what he's saying. And I think he did that well. I think he articulated the view of a lot of Republicans and a lot of conservatives where challenges exist, we must address them. But on the whole, you know, the promise of America is good. The promise of America is for equality and democracy. And I think he was able to communicate that message in a very clear way that a lot of us really appreciated.
And the messenger matters, Josh, because I just want to say really quickly that one of the things I don't know if everyone noticed is that when Mike Pence gave his speech, again, his first speech since leaving the vice presidency, and he was praising Tim Scott, he then says, "And America is not a racist country." And I thought, wow, that landed a lot differently coming from you.
Yeah, one more thing I wanted to add to about what Tim Scott was saying was, because it was this appeal to common ground, one of the things he said very clearly was, can we just not make everything about race? Like, can we actually work together where everything is not a racial issue? And that I think, is a real key issue for Democrats and Republicans right now if they're going to work together.
Well, I mean, and another person who said America is not a racist country this week is Vice President Kamala Harris when she was asked about that line in Tim Scott's speech. But I also think it sounds different coming from her, which is to say that I think, you know, especially, I mean, partly it's liberals, you know, giving, you know, a pass to people on their own team. But it's also that, you know, the liberal listeners to Kamala Harris, I mean, you know, obviously she has her detractors to her left, but basically that they see her as having the right policy commitments that make clear that she takes seriously concerns about race and racism in the United States. And so it does, when you say that phrase, it doesn't sound like you're giving people permission to ignore racism. And maybe it's unfair that people ascribe that idea to Tim Scott as well. I think it partly has to do with the high emotions over the Georgia law. But again, I think the context dependence of using that phrase isn't simply about whether the person saying the phrase is black or white. Gustavo, I was wondering if we can get your thoughts
on this. Yeah, America is a racist country. Come on, folks. America was founded on racism, genocide, and conquest. That's literally our history. But that said, there is still that promise of America that made people like Frederick Douglass embrace the Constitution, embrace the Declaration of Independence. Tim Scott, he also talked about his Christian faith. And if you're a Christian, you believe that all of us are sinners. Okay, what do you do with that? Do you burn yourself down and kill yourself? No, you work toward becoming a better person. So in the United, I've always found it odd that Republicans can't just embrace this history and then try to reform it. On the other hand, though, rhetoric like that, and going back to your original point, Josh, about why Republicans were able to make inroads with black men and Latino men, a speech like Tim Scott's talking about his story, pulling himself up by the bootstraps, his family, that line from Cotton to Congress is just a brilliant line that mm-hmm. he's going to carry mm-hmm. with him, and rightfully so, forever. It's a story that resonates with the working class. And I think far too often with the left and Democrats, they forget about the working class. So when I heard that speech, part of me, I'm like, yeah, I see what you're saying. You're like, yeah, there's problems, but we as individuals, we have to work with them. For Latino males, I've called it the phenomenon of rancho libertarianism. In other words, from my generation, a lot of us are the children of Mexicans who come from rural towns, who have this libertarian perspective. We don't want the government. You cannot make any excuses. Do not whine about society. And so that appeals a lot to, you know, my cousins. And what I always told the Republicans, though, it's like, look, you had, oh my God, you could have conquered the Republicans going all the way back to Reagan, who understood this and was telling his party to embrace it. But instead, you put your lot with a bunch of xenophobes who, you know, talk about the great replacement theory and bringing in all these Latinos. And why do they speak Spanish? And why do they park their cars on the lawns? When you hear rhetoric like that, even though my cousins, who, by the way, are not the most enlightened people on race, when they hear that, they're like, you know what? I'm not going to vote for the Republican Party. I'm going to go for the Democrats. It happened here in California. The phenomenon turnaround of Trump, though, is that he spoke in Spanish, you say, sin pelos en la lengua, without any hair on the tongue. In other words, you're plain spoken. You don't care what people say. And that resonates with the working class. And the sooner the Democrats realize it, the sooner they can, you know, stop Republicans from getting those voters. And by the way, I see this phenomenon coming if the Republicans don't mess it up. But they always do, of course.
I want to turn back to one more area in President Biden's speech, which is immigration. Now, I've seen a lot of conservatives characterize it that Biden did not talk at all about the crisis at the southern border. And by the way, I know Rachel said earlier in the show, Biden likes to call everything a crisis. This is the one thing that he and his administration really try very hard not to call a crisis, trying to emphasize that there has been a problem there for years, although it has significantly escalated in the last few months. But when Biden talked about migration from Central America to the U.S.-Mexico border, he hit a point that Gustavo was hitting on last week's show, basically saying, you know, we need to invest more in economic development and security in these Central American countries so that people do not want to leave and come here, and that he has tasked Vice President Harris with this, you know, frankly, thankless task of trying to address this issue. But the thing I see when I look at that is, you know, I can see that having some medium-term effectiveness, and Gustavo was saying last week, you know, it's like the Marshall Plan, but that's not going to change who wants to come to the U.S. border in August of this year, or especially in, you know, when we get into next winter, when the temperatures start coming down again. And so I guess this issue is the number two issue that the Gallup poll identifies when they call people up and ask an open-ended question: what's the most important problem facing America? It's chasing number one. Coronavirus is at 20. Immigration-related issues are at number 14. And so it felt to me like Biden did not have a ton to offer on this issue. He wants a comprehensive immigration reform bill, which people have been trying for in Washington for 15 plus years. He's not going to get it. He has this economic development initiative that might deliver something in the long term, but won't in the short term. So I didn't see anything in here that indicated that the White House has a handle on this or is going to be in a position on immigration in a few months that works better for them than where they are right now. Am I wrong about any of that?
When I heard that line, actually, I thought that, going to Rachel's point, that was kind of bipartisanship saying, hey, Republicans, I know there's a problem at the border. And that's his characterization, not mine. So I agree with you. There's a problem. We have to fix it with that. But it was just one line. So, yeah, it seemed weird that he just threw a line out there, then didn't really elaborate on it, because frankly, what is there to elaborate on? It's not going to go anywhere because, again, of the hyper bipartisanship that has stopped anything from happening going back to Reagan.
Well, also, but there's another reason too that I think that he didn't have a lot to say on this, right? Which is because the Obama and Biden administration's record on deportations was not that much smaller than Trump's.
Deporter in chief.
So there is a that's actually a lightning rod issue where perhaps, to Rachel's point, there is more common ground with conservatives than he wants the left to kind of be reminded of. So I don't know that there were huge benefits to him getting into specifics. I do think, however, though, going back to what Gustavo said a moment ago, that let's not forget that George W. Bush won, 22% or something, 23% of Latino voters. And he reemerged this week talking about the need for the tone to shift in America on this issue. So, you know, I think that Gustavo made a lot of great points. I think the main point, though, that I just want to say that this all ties into, and I really did spark to what Gustavo was saying, is that there's been so much talk that Democrats focus too much on identity politics. I actually think that's not entirely accurate. I think that Democrats simply misunderstand that not all people define their race as their sole identity. And that's what's happening with a lot of those minority male voters. And they're not the only ones. So I just wanted to throw that out there as part of this conversation, Josh.
Rachel, what did you make of the president on immigration?
So, you know, it's funny when you and I were chatting briefly before this, when I said he didn't mention the border, you know, he really didn't. Like, there was one throwaway line and the rest of it was about immigration reform. But that's a completely separate issue from the actual crisis that's going on at the southern border. And there was a Washington Post ABC poll that came out before the address that I think said 53% of Americans say they disapprove of what Biden is doing at the border, which is nothing. And he's tasked, you know, Kamala Harris with dealing with this. She's never made one single trip to the border. And when asked when she was going to go, she said, well, I'm not going to play politics. But, you know, we have a problem. The border's on fire. You know, crossings are up 71% since February. There's 20,000 children. That's doubled since February. this is a criminal cartel enterprise flourishing at the border, and we're not doing anything about it. Now, to Gustavo's point, I actually do think that you would find some common ground with Republicans on the need to sort of address this, the structural deficiencies in these countries. I think there's conservatives that acknowledge the reality that you simply cannot. We're about to have some failed states at our southern border, and you can't share a border with failed states. But the issue is that it has to be conditional. And when Joe Biden came into office, he undid the safe third country agreements that Trump had negotiated with these countries in exchange in some areas for U.S. support and U.S. help. There are Republicans that would be willing to go down that road again. But with Democrats, it's never been conditional. It's, you know, simply been, we'll throw money at these countries, require them to do nothing. And that's just simply not tenable. And so that's been, I think, the story of immigration reform from the conservative perspective is, you know, there are Republicans that want to address not only the illegal immigration, but legal immigration in ways I think some Democrats could actually get behind. But they want to address the border. They want to get border security right. They want to reform the asylum laws. And those efforts, in the minds of many conservatives, have just never been serious.
Let's take a break. I've been talking with Rachel Bovard of the Conservative Partnership Institute, Gustavo Arellano of the LA Times, and Kelly Goff, LRC contributor and columnist. We will be back to talk about hamburgers, cigarettes, and weed. You're listening to Left, Right, and Center.
You're hearing civilized yet provocative opinions from all sides. Now we need to know what you think. Tweet us at LRCKCRW. Stream all episodes of Left, Right, and Center and our companion show, All the President's Lawyers, at kcrw.com/podcasts or from the KCRW app.
Back again with Left, Right, and Center. I'm your host, Josh Barrow. On the right is Rachel Bovard, Senior Director of Policy at the Conservative Partnership Institute. On the left is Gustavo Arellano, columnist at the Los Angeles Times and host of the podcast, The Times. And our special guest is Kelly Goff, Left, Right, and Center contributor, writer, and columnist. So I have three stories I want to talk about whether the government will tell you what to do in your own personal consumption behavior. In a moment, we're going to talk about beef, which Joe Biden doesn't want to limit you to 4 pounds a year of, though climate advocates do say we need to eat much less beef in order to address climate change. And I also want to talk about marijuana legalization, which Joe Biden is not so cool as the rest of the Democratic Party on. But first, let's talk about menthols. The Biden administration is moving to prohibit menthol cigarettes. The government is concerned that menthols are easier to market to teenagers. This is the reason that other kinds of flavored cigarettes have been prohibited for years. But the longstanding history of menthol marketing in black communities has been both part of the argument for prohibiting them and also part of the argument for continuing to allow them. About a quarter of white smokers in the U.S. smoke menthols, which means the average menthol smoker in the U.S. is white. But menthols have over 70% market share among black smokers. And while black and white Americans have similar smoking rates, black smokers are less likely than white smokers to quit, according to the CDC. The FDA believes a menthol ban could cause almost 1 million additional Americans, including about 250,000 African Americans, to quit smoking within the first 18 months of the ban. So the menthol ban has black political advocates divided. Is it a good way to push black smoking rates down and improve health outcomes? Or is it a paternalistic move to specifically target black smokers while continuing to allow the most popular products for white smokers? Does anyone want to stick up for the menthol ban? Should the government prohibit these?
Well, again, I think this conversation might have been different pre-COVID. I mean, I will say that I haven't specifically lost relatives to menthol smoking, but I've certainly lost relatives in my family to preventable death. And I can't recall if I've already said this, and it's only relevant because we're on the radio, which I'm African American. And so, and I would say that the health disparities that were so, I mean, COVID's shown such a spotlight on how many people died from COVID disproportionately in my community because of conditions that were fundamentally preventable, as well as health disparities in terms of health access. And so I don't have a problem with bans like these. And the thing is, they work, Josh. I mean, remember how many years ago was it that everyone was up in arms and said that Bloomberg's political career would be over because he got rid of smoking in bars? And surprise, surprise, it actually worked. And it significantly lowered the number of New Yorkers who were smoking and ended up saving people, saving the city millions and millions and millions upon dollars. So I don't think things like this are a bad thing because the data shows that they actually work and they save us all money in the long run, in addition to saving lives, which I actually think is more important.
Gustavo, I think one challenge with this is, you know, it's not that difficult to take a standard cigarette and apply menthol flavoring to it. It's basically just, you know, it's like essence of like mint type flavor, more or less. And so one concern is that you're going to have black market menthol production, which is not to say people making cigarettes in the black market, but they'll buy regular cigarettes and apply flavoring and sell them through illegal channels, and then you get government enforcement. And you know, Eric Garner, who you know who died at the hands of an NYPD officer, that was the enforcement of illegal cigarette sales. So I think that's one additional problem with this sort of ban, is that if you're going to then have the government have to go out and enforce this, especially in black communities, but in any community, then you just have yet another point of contact between the government and between the police and the public over you know, a nonviolent manner.
Yeah, I've smoked exactly one cigarette in my life. The day before I graduated from college, I didn't care for it, so I've never really cared about smoking as an issue. But I do care about prohibition. And when it's interesting to me that, you know, we're talking about more and more legalization of marijuana, and now at the same time, we are thinking about banning menthol cigarettes. I'm sorry, but let the people decide what they want to smoke. If they want to ruin their lives, well, hey, you know what? That's on them. I did that one cigarette. It didn't appeal to me. And if it did appeal to me, eventually, I wouldn't have done it either. And if we're going to ban menthol cigarettes, let's also ban tequila. Latinos, there's huge alcoholic rates among Latinos. My dad, including one of them, he's been sober for 36 years. Why don't we start banning them? At some point, and I'm all for decriminalization of most consumptions of things that make you get high or things that make you calm down or whatnot. But let the person decide. If they want to ruin it for them and they want to be a burden on the state, well, that's on them. But that's where I do see then the government having a vested interest. If they see billions upon billions of dollars being spent in trying to stop people from smoking or trying to, you know, not cure them, but take care of them, then I understand why you have these movements. But for me, yeah, don't ban them. Again, if people want to mess up their lungs, God bless you.
I agree with everything Gustavo just said. I find these bans to be infantilizing, particularly when they're focused at individual communities. I do think that there can be as much transparency in advertising. The more information consumers have to make informed choices, the better. But I do think that concerns raised about overcriminalization are also valid. You know, you tend when you push products out of the market, you tend to create a black market, and that never ends well for anyone.
What about marijuana? I think it's interesting how the partisan lines have gotten scrambled on some of these issues. You've seen smoking restrictions and frankly successful efforts to fight smoking that have a lot of support on both sides of the aisle. And then for marijuana, it's generally been a partisan issue where Republicans are more inclined toward prohibition than Democrats. But we have President Joe Biden, who I really like on a lot of issues, who even though marijuana legalization has become very popular, his view is still that marijuana should be illegal at the federal level, that we need more study before we can figure out whether we can legalize it or not.
And White House staffers, that he wouldn't hire White House staffers who said they smoked pot. And even though the VP has acknowledged that she smoked pot, but continue. Sorry, Josh.
No. I just like that. That feels like an area where the president could get more libertarian, and it would benefit him both politically and would be better policy. So I've been finding it surprising that, you know, at the same time that we're going to have this further restriction on cigarettes, that there is not this effort to acknowledge what the situation is at the state level, that this is a de facto legal product, to go ahead and legalize it.
Maybe what Joe's seeing is what's happening out in California, and going back to Rachel's point about the black market. So here in California, we legalized marijuana a couple of years ago. I could go down to, not too far away and find many cannabis clinics where I could get, you know, pills or all that stuff. But that hasn't stopped the black market. That hasn't stopped the cartels. Far from it. There's more black market marijuana out there than ever before. So maybe that's why Joe Biden is a little bit hesitant in that. I think more than anything, though, what Joe Biden should be doing is what you have seen from a lot of advocates on the left, is that you have to have more decriminalization. So you cannot have these punitive laws that target, especially black and brown men who inordinately have been affected by criminalization of crack, of marijuana, of cocaine and all that. I still find it ironic that Republicans only found religion on decriminalization when it was an opioid crisis and you started seeing a lot of working class white people getting ruined on that. And for the record, I've only smoked marijuana once, just like cigarettes. It wasn't for me, so nah.
Well, and Rachel, you also have former House Speaker John Boehner as a marijuana lobbyist at this point. So why hasn't there been more shift among actual elected officials in the Republican Party on this issue?
I think they see it as sort of happening naturally, because you almost have two legal regimes in this country right now, because you have 36 states have legalized medical marijuana. 16 states have just legalized marijuana wholesale. And so I think this is just, they're letting the slow creep of federalism work here, because at some point the Department of Justice is going to have to, I think, allow, just respond to the states in this regard. So I think it's sort of happening naturally.
Gustavo, the flagged a really important issue, Josh, which is this is sort of, again, going back to the conversation about systemic racism. There are a lot of Black business people who have pointed out that there are a lot of African-American men who had their lives ruined by going to prison for nonviolent drug offenses. And now, following the opioid crisis, following the legalization of marijuana, there are a lot of business people, many of whom are not Black, who are getting rich off of the legalization of marijuana. And this is what makes, again, the political conversations about these issues really complicated, because I think that's something worth remembering. And the last thing I'll say, too, is the other reason I think we haven't seen as much movement from Joe Biden is because his son has battled addiction for many years. And as someone who has known that the parents of people who've battled addiction, a lot of them end up taking a hard line on drugs, regardless of whether they're drugs that the rest of society has deemed harmless.
We're running short on time, so I'm going to bracket the beef conversation for another week. But suffice to say, there is no Joe Biden proposal to limit you to 4 pounds of beef a year. There is a serious conversation to be had about the contribution of agriculture and beef production to climate change and what we're going to do about that. And we will talk about that in the future. But for now, go ahead. Biden's not trying to take away your hamburger from you.
Yay.
We've reached that time once again for our famed Left, Right, and Center rants featuring pet peeves from across the political spectrum. Gustavo Arellano, what's your soapbox?
Oscar so white? Maybe not so much anymore, but Oscar so not Latino? Probably forever. So this year's Academy Awards nominations were hailed as some of the most diverse ever. You had a great, great selection of Black candidates, Asian American candidates, even the first Muslim actor, Muslim ever nominated for a Best Actor award with Riz Ahmed for the great movie Sound of Metal. But what was missing? Mostly Latinos. Really, you only had three. You had two Mexicanos from Mexico nominated for Best Sound for Sound of Metal. And then you had Shaka King, who directed Judas and the Black Messiah for Best Director and Best Screenplay. He's of Panamanian descent. But that's only three out of all these nominees. In a country where Latinos are the biggest minority in the United States, in a region where Hollywood is located, where Latinos make up more than half the population. Again and again and again, Hollywood forgets that there's Latinos who are living in this world, and especially Latinos who live here in the United States. It brings back to me this one of my favorite quotes ever about Hollywood that Chris Rock said in The Hollywood Reporter. He said, forget whether Hollywood is Black enough. A better question is Hollywood Mexican enough? You're in LA, you've got to try not to hire Mexicans. And that's true. I worked in Hollywood for a couple of years. I quickly soured on it because I realized that most Hollywood producers, executives, and writers, they only know Latinos in two ways. The people that they meet at work, which are the janitors and the security guards, and the people that they know at their homes, which are going to be the nannies and the gardeners. So Hollywood, please realize there are more Latinos out there. Make movies about us. Get us in. I mean, it's so sad that even in the Oscars, the only other Latinos who showed up was Cliff for Steven Spielberg's West Side Story, remake of West Side Story, a film from the 1960s, and the original star in there, Rita Moreno. That's it, Hollywood. There are more Latinos than us. Please get out of your bubble, and please, please, please leave Boyle Heights alone.
Rachel Bovard, what's your rant?
So one of the rare areas of bipartisanship in the last year has been, surprisingly, on antitrust enforcement. President Trump's Department of Justice engaged this agenda, bringing a major antitrust lawsuit against Google. President Biden has an opportunity to continue it by nominating a solid antitrust enforcer at DOJ. But one of his candidates is Jonathan Salad, who is an Obama alumni with ties to Silicon Valley and someone who, as The Intercept reported this week, urged Democrat attorneys general not to back the case against Google only because it would give Trump a win. Antitrust enforcement is turning into one of those rare unicorns, an area where Republicans and Democrats actually want to work together. Biden should give them a nominee that reflects this model, and Jonathan Salad isn't it.
Kelly Goff, what's on your mind?
Well, as I continue my quest to look for news stories that represent good news, I came across the story of the Bruce family. 100 years ago, African Americans Charles and Willa Bruce had a thriving lodging and entertainment business on a stretch of property they owned in scenic Manhattan Beach here in California. Though business boomed, unfortunately, they were harassed by the Ku Klux Klan, and while they hung on to their business as long as they could, the city of Manhattan Beach eventually seized it, citing eminent domain, and did not adequately compensate the couple for displacing them or destroying their livelihood. So why does this represent good news? because this week it was announced that a California Senate bill that would return the land, now worth approximately $75 million, to the Bruce's family's descendants, is one step closer to becoming a reality. The efforts have been spearheaded by a racially and politically diverse coalition of California legislators, including State Senator Steve Bradford and Supervisor Janice Hahn. The story of the Bruce family, who worked so hard to achieve the American dream, and the commitment of those working to ensure they receive the justice they were denied so long ago, epitomizes the best of America, and that is certainly good news worth celebrating.
For my rant, your glassware is too big. When you're picking the right glass to serve a drink in, the idea is the glass should enhance the drink. So a big red wine glass lets the wine breathe and captures aroma so you can smell the wine. Those glasses should be big, you just shouldn't fill them up very much. But for other kinds of drinks, your primary concern is about keeping the drink as cold as it is supposed to be served, or as hot as it's supposed to be if we're talking about a coffee mug. If you're drinking a carbonated drink, you want a narrow glass so that it will retain the bubbles. When your glasses and your mugs are too big, then your drinks are too big, they take too long to drink, your coffee gets cold, your soft drinks get hot, and for this reason, your glasses should be no more than 12 ounces and usually smaller. A good cocktail glass should be less than 6 ounces, because a martini needs to stay cold without any ice floating in it. If you have a cocktail glass as big as your head, unless you're trying to make a viral Instagram story, you're just making a drink with too much alcohol. It's going to get you drunk, and unless you chug it, it's going to be warm by the time you finish. You need moderation in everything, and moderate glassware will help you stay moderate in your drinking. That's all we have time for today. I want to thank Rachel Bovard, Gustavo Arellano, and Kelly Goff. Left, Right, and Center is produced by Sarah Fay and recorded and mixed by Kat Yore and Michael Stark. Todd M. Simon composed our theme music. I'm Josh Barrow. Thanks for joining us, and tune in next week for more of Left, Right, and Center.
Download and subscribe at kcrw.com/LRC, the KCRW app, or wherever you find podcasts. Left, Right, and Center is produced and distributed by KCRW.